Chapter 3. Space and Time. In such a short book, I'm unable to cover all areas of physics, fascinating though so many of them are. Instead, I've distilled our current understanding of the physical universe down to three central pillars, three pictures of reality that come from very different directions. The first of these, introduced in this chapter and the next, is built on the work of Albert Einstein in the early 20th century. It lays out our present understanding of the way matter and energy behave within space and time on the very largest scales due to the influence of gravity, an understanding that is encompassed in his famous general theory of relativity. In order to paint Einstein's picture of the world, we must start with the canvas itself. Space and time are the substrates in which all events take place. However, such concepts are slippery. Common sense tells us that space and time should be in place from the start, that space is where events happen and the laws of physics are acted out, while the inexorable passage of time is, well, just is. But is our common sense view of space and time right? An important lesson physicists must learn is to not always trust common sense. After all, common sense tells us that the Earth is flat, but even the ancient Greeks understood that its sheer size meant we couldn't easily discern its curvature, but that there were simple experiments they could perform to prove that it was in fact a sphere. Similarly, everyday experience tells us that light has the properties of a wave, and therefore cannot also behave as though it were made up of a stream of individual particles. If it were, how could we explain interference patterns? And yet it has been proven beyond doubt through careful experiments that our senses can deceive us when it comes to the nature of light. And when it comes to the quantum world, we must abandon many everyday notions based on simple intuition if we are to truly understand what is going on. Learning not to always trust our senses is a valuable skill that physicists have inherited from the philosophers. As far back as 1641, René Descartes argued in his Meditations on First Philosophy that in order to know things about the material world that were absolutely true, he first needed to doubt everything, often despite what his senses were telling him. This doesn't mean that we cannot believe anything we are told or shown, but that, according to Descartes, those material things he judges to be true demand a mind fully free of prejudices, and which can be easily detached from the affairs of the senses. In fact, long before even Descartes considered this, the medieval scholar Ibn al-Haytham began a philosophical movement in the early 11th century, known in Arabic as al-Shukuk, the doubts, and he wrote extensively, particularly on the celestial mechanics of the Greeks, that one should question past knowledge and not take what one is told without evidence. This is why physics has always been an empirical science, relying on the scientific method of testing hypotheses and theories through experimentation. Nevertheless, some of the most important breakthroughs in physics have been the result of the logical conclusions drawn not from real experiments or observations, but from thought experiments, whereby the physicist considers some hypothesis and devises an imaginary experiment that can test its consequences. Such an experiment may or may not be possible to perform in practice, but it can still provide us with a valuable tool to learn about the world through the power of logic and reasoning alone. Some of the most famous thought experiments were conducted by Einstein and helped him develop his theories of relativity. Once his theories were fully developed, of course, they could be tested in real laboratory experiments. When it comes to the meaning of space and time, the difficulty we have is not surprising, for we are ourselves imprisoned within them. And it's hard to free our minds from their confines and see reality from the outside. And yet, incredibly, this is possible to do. In this chapter, I'll outline our current understanding of the nature of space and time, a celebration of the debt we owe to Einstein and his two beautiful theories of relativity. How does a physicist define space and time? An important characteristic of Newtonian physics is that space and time have a real existence, independent of the matter and energy that exist within them. But philosophers the world over had contemplated this idea long before Newton. For instance, Aristotle believed that empty space did not exist in its own right, that without matter there can be no space. Much later, Descartes argued that space was no more than the distance or extension between bodies. According to these two great thinkers, the space inside an empty box only exists because of the confines of the box. Take away the walls of the box, and the volume that was inside it no longer has any meaning. But let us explore this example a little. What if you subsequently discovered that the box was sitting within the empty space of a larger one? Does the space within the smaller box, after its walls are removed, continue to exist now that it forms a part of the volume in the larger box? And must it therefore have been a real thing all along? Imagine now that the empty smaller box, whereby empty I mean truly devoid of anything, a vacuum, is moving in a vacuum contained within the larger box. Is the empty space inside the smaller box the same empty space as it moves, or is it occupying different parts of the space within the larger box? This is easy to answer if we replace the empty space inside the sealed smaller box with water. As the box moves around within a larger volume of water, we can accept that it contains the same water molecules inside it, while displacing the water outside as it moves. But what if there is no water? And what if we now get rid of the physical walls of both boxes and everything else in this imaginary universe, so that all that is left is nothingness? Is that nothingness still something? Does this empty space exist, ready to be filled with matter, or to be contained within the confines of a box? Maybe I'm just asking the same question in different ways, but only because it's by no means a trivial one. Isaac Newton believed that space has to exist in order for matter and energy to be contained within it and for events to take place within it. That space exists, he argued, only as an empty nothingness, independently of the laws of physics that govern the behavior of matter and energy within it. For Newton, space is the canvas on which reality is painted. For without space, and time, of course, to fix events to, how would we be able to assign coordinates to locate events? Surely they must happen at some point in space, and at some moment in time. Without absolute space and time and place, how can we hope to anchor reality? But was Newton right? The answer we can give today is both yes and no. Sorry. He was correct in the sense that space is real. It's more than just the gaps between things, as Descartes had argued. But he was wrong about space having an absolute existence independently of what it contains. These two statements sound contradictory until you learn about Einsteinian relativity. Einstein proved that absolute space and absolute time do not exist as separate entities. But to appreciate why this notion is necessary, I need to introduce you to the first of his two theories of relativity. Einstein's special theory. Until Isaac Newton completed his work on the laws of motion, debates about the nature of time were considered to be the domain of philosophy and metaphysics rather than proper science. Newton described how objects move and behave under the influence of forces, and since all motion or change requires time to make any sense, time had to be included as a fundamental part of his mathematical description of the world. But Newtonian time is absolute and relentless. It flows at a constant rate, as though there were an imaginary cosmic clock ticking off the seconds, hours, days, and years, independently of the events and processes taking place in space. Then in 1905, Einstein brought the Newtonian world crashing down by revealing how time is connected to space at a deep level. Einstein's conclusion was that time is not absolute. It doesn't run at the same rate for everyone. If I see two simultaneous events, say two flashes of light from sources on either side of me, then someone else moving past me at that very moment will not see them happening at the same time, but rather one slightly after the other. This is because the rate of flow of time for each of us depends on our state of motion relative to each other. This weird notion is one of the very first lessons of relativity theory, and is called the relativity of simultaneity. Let's take a step back and look at these concepts more carefully. Consider how sound waves travel to your ears. Sound is, after all, nothing more than the vibration of air molecules that pass on energy through their collisions. Without matter, air, there would be no sound. In space, no one can hear you scream, as the byline to the 1980s movie Alien correctly pointed out. Einstein's insight was to suggest that, unlike sound waves, light waves do not need a medium to carry them. His theory rested on two ideas, known as the principles of relativity. The first, originating with Galileo, states that all motion is relative, and that there is no experiment that can be performed to show that someone or something is truly at rest. The second principle states that light waves travel at a speed that is independent of the speed of the source of the light. Both these ideas seem reasonable until you dig a little deeper into their implications. Let us consider the second idea first, that light moves at the same speed for everyone, and carry out a simple thought experiment. Imagine an approaching car on an empty country road. The sound waves from its engine will reach you ahead of the car since they're travelling faster. But their speed has to do with how quickly the vibrating air molecules can transmit them. They do not reach you any quicker if the car speeds up. What happens instead is that they get compressed to shorter wavelengths. This is the well-known Doppler effect that we recognize as the change in pitch of the car as it finally reaches you and goes past. When it's receding, the waves of sound are emitted from a progressively longer distance away and therefore reach us stretched to longer wavelengths and hence a lower pitch. So while the wavelength of sound waves depends on the speed of their source, the speed of the waves themselves, relative to us, how long they take to reach us, does not change unless we start moving through the air towards the approaching car. So far, so good, I hope. Light is different. It does not need a medium to travel through, and with respect to which we can measure its speed. This means that no one has a privileged position in which they can say they are truly at rest and therefore can reliably measure the true speed of light. Einstein concluded from this that we should all measure light to have the same speed regardless of how fast we are moving relative to each other, provided, that is, we are not undergoing any acceleration or deceleration while measuring the speed of light some distance away from us. This is a technical detail. Basically, general relativity deals with non-inertial reference frames, where space-time appears curved due to gravity or acceleration. In such non-inertial frames, you only measure light to have a constant speed as it passes close to you. Now, consider two rockets approaching each other at constant speed close to that of light. But they have no reference point to argue over who is or isn't moving. An astronaut on board one rocket sends a pulse of light towards the oncoming second rocket, measuring the speed of the pulse as it travels away from him. Since he can legitimately claim to be at rest, floating in empty space, while the other rocket is doing all the moving, he should see the light moving away from him at its usual speed of just over 1 billion kilometers per hour. The speed of light in empty space is 1.07925284888 billion kilometers per hour. And he does indeed see this. But at the same time, the astronaut in the second rocket can also legitimately claim to be floating stationary in space. She too will therefore expect to measure the speed of the light reaching her to be just over 1 billion kilometers per hour, since, like the sound waves from the car, the light's speed should not depend on the speed that its source is approaching her. And she does indeed measure light to have this speed. It would seem, therefore, that both astronauts measure the same light pulse to be travelling at the same speed, despite moving towards each other themselves at near light speed. This strange nature of light turns out to be a property of the speed at which it can travel rather than that of light itself, a speed that is the maximum possible in our universe and which stitches space and time together into one fabric. For the only way light can travel at the same speed for all observers, regardless of how fast they themselves are moving relative to each other, is if our concepts of distance and time change. Here is another example. Imagine that you, on Earth, send out a series of light pulses, or flashes, into space to chase down a friend who's headed off in a very fast rocket. A powerful, futuristic one that can travel at 99% of the speed of light. You will measure the light pulses to be travelling away from you at 1 billion kilometres per hour, and therefore slowly overtaking your friend's rocket at just 1% of the speed of light, in the same way that a car in the fast lane of a motorway that is travelling just a little faster than one in the slow lane overtakes it at a speed that is the difference between their two speeds. But what does your friend in the rocket see if she tracks the overtaking light pulses? Relativity theory tells us that she will see them overtaking her at 1 billion kilometers per hour. Remember, the speed of light is constant and all observers see it traveling at the same speed. The only way for this to make sense is if time on board the rocket is ticking by at a slower pace than for you on Earth. That way, what you see as the slow overtaking of a light pulse past the rocket window, your friend sees as a light pulse flashing past, because very little time will have elapsed on the rocket's slower ticking clock, although for your friend, the clock is ticking at a normal rate. Thus, one of the consequences of all observers seeing light moving at the same speed is that we all measure distances and times differently. And we do indeed see this. The constancy of the speed of light for all observers is a fact, verified experimentally over and over again, and without which our world wouldn't make sense. The special theory of relativity resolves this counterintuitive situation beautifully by combining time and space in order to retrieve something that we can all agree on. Imagine the whole of space is contained within a vast, rectangular, three-dimensional box. To define an event taking place within the box, we assign to it X, Y, and Z coordinates, indicating its position relative to the three axes of the box, along with a value for time, when the event took place. Common sense would tell us that the time value is quite different from the three numbers defining the event's location in space. But what if we could add a time axis to the three of space? It would need to be in a direction that is at right angles to each of the three spatial axes, which is impossible for us to visualize. This would result in a combined four-dimensional volume of space plus time. An obvious simplification to help us with this visualization is to sacrifice one of the dimensions of space and collapse our 3D volume onto a two-dimensional surface, leaving the freed-up third dimension to use as the time axis. Now, think of this static block of space and time as a giant loaf of sliced bread, where the time axis lies along the length of the loaf. Each slice of bread is a snapshot of the whole of space at a single moment, while successive slices correspond to successive times. This is known in physics as the block universe model. While it is only three-dimensional, two of space and one of time, we must not forget that it really represents a four-dimensional construct, 4D space-time. Mathematically, we don't have a problem dealing with four dimensions, it's just picturing them that is not possible. Perceiving 4D space-time from the outside, we would experience the totality of existence, not only of all space, but of all times, past, present and future, coexisting and frozen. It's an impossible viewpoint, an omniscient one, because in reality we are always trapped within the block universe, and we experience the passage of time as a steady crawl along the time axis, moving smoothly from one slice of the loaf to the next, like frames in a movie stacked alongside each other instead of end to end on a reel. The reason the concept of the block universe is useful is because it allows us to understand our different perspectives according to relativity theory. Two observers moving at high speed relative to each other might each record two events, say flashes of light, but they will not agree on how far apart those flashes are or the time interval between them. This is the price we must pay if we are to all see light moving at the same speed. Viewed within the four dimensions of the block universe, spatial distances and time intervals can be combined. So the separation between any two events, called the space-time interval, will be the same for all observers. Their disagreement about distances and times, if treated separately, turns out to be nothing more than different perspectives in space-time. You and I can look at a cube from different angles so that what I see as its depth, the distance measured along my line of sight, will not appear the same to you if you see it face on. It depends on the angle at which we're looking at it. But we can nevertheless agree that it is a cube of equal length sides and that any differences are just down to our different perspectives. The same is happening in the 4D block universe. We will always agree on space-time intervals between events. Einstein's relativity teaches us that we must view things within 4D space-time, in which both spatial and temporal distances become just a matter of perspective. No observer has the right to claim that their perspective of space and time is more correct than any other, because we'll all agree once space and time are combined. Individual perspectives of space and time separately are relative, but combined space-time is absolute. Einstein's general theory. Just as the special theory merges space with time, Einstein's general theory of relativity links space-time with matter and energy, which I will discuss further in the next chapter, to give a more profound explanation of the concept of gravity than that of Newton. According to Newton, gravity is an attractive force, an invisible rubber band between masses that pulls them together and acts instantaneously between them, no matter how far apart they are. Einstein gives us a deeper and more accurate explanation, that the strength of the gravitational pull that a body feels is a measure of the curvature of space-time around it. Again, this curvature is not something we can visualize. It's impossible to imagine flat 4D space-time, let alone when it's curved. For most everyday purposes, Newton's depiction of gravity as a force is a good enough approximation to reality. But its shortcomings become ever more evident when gravity gets a lot stronger, such as when we approach a black hole, or if we need to measure distances and times more accurately, such as on board GPS satellites. In such cases, we are forced to abandon the Newtonian picture and fully embrace Einstein's vision of curved space-time. Since gravity is defined by the curvature of space-time, this means that it influences the passage of time as well as the shape of space. For us, embedded within space-time, this effect manifests itself as a slowing down of time, in a similar way to what we see when objects move close to the speed of light. The stronger the gravity, the slower a clock will tick, compared to one far from the source of the field, in a flatter region of space-time. Unfortunately for those who prefer complex ideas explained in plain language rather than dense mathematics, most attempts by physicists to describe how and why time runs more slowly in stronger gravity fall short of either explaining the phenomenon correctly or explaining it at all. But I will try. Just as two people moving relative to each other will, according to special relativity, measure each other's clock ticking at a slower rate, a similar situation arises between the two observers if they are a fixed distance apart, but one of them is feeling a stronger gravitational pull, say on the surface of the Earth, while the other is hovering far out in space. Again, the two of them will disagree on the time interval between events. As before, their clocks will tick at different rates. Being deeper within the Earth's gravitational well, where there is more space-time curvature, the Earth observer's clock will tick more slowly. However, unlike in special relativity, the situation here is no longer symmetrical, as she would see the clock out in space ticking more quickly. In a very real sense, gravity slows the flow of time. We can say that the reason that a body falls to Earth is because it always moves to where time runs the slowest. It's trying to age more slowly. Isn't that beautiful? So much then for the effect of gravity on time. But what about space? What does general relativity tell us beyond the somewhat unhelpful remark that gravity causes space to curve? Remember how both Aristotle and Descartes argued that without any matter to fill it, space did not have an independent existence? Well, Einstein would take this a step further. According to his general theory, matter and energy create a gravitational field, and space-time is nothing more than the structural quality of this field. Without the stuff contained within space-time, there is no gravitational field, and hence no space or time. This may sound somewhat philosophical, and I suspect even some physicists will be uncomfortable with it. The problem is, in part, down to the way we teach physics. We tend to start with special relativity and flat space-time, because it's easier to teach and because Einstein hit upon it first. Then we progress on to the more difficult general relativity, in which this flat space-time is filled with matter and energy, causing it to curve. In fact, conceptually, we should think of it the other way round, beginning with the matter and energy within space-time. This way, special relativity is just an idealized approximation that only works when gravity is so weak that space-time can be regarded as flat. The point I wish to make is a subtle one, and you can take solace from the fact that even Einstein himself didn't fully appreciate its implications to begin with. 2 years after completing the general theory, he wrote a popular science book, or booklet as he referred to it, entitled Relativity, the Special and the General Theory, a Popular Exposition, which was first published in German in 1916. Over the next 4 decades of his life, as he honed his understanding of what the maths told him about the universe, he would add appendices to this booklet. In 1954, the year before he died, he wrote his 5th and final appendix, 2 dozen pages of prose containing some of the most profound ideas ever produced by the human mind. To understand Einstein's thinking, we must understand the concept of a field in physics. The simplest definition of a field is that it's a region of space containing some form of energy or influence, in which every point can be assigned a value that describes the nature of the field at that point. Think of the magnetic field surrounding a bar magnet. The field is strongest close to the poles of the magnet, and becomes progressively weaker the further away in space from the magnets we get. The pattern of iron filings that arrange themselves along the magnetic field lines is simply their way of reacting to the field they are immersed in. But the point I wish to make sounds too obvious to warrant stating. The magnetic field needs space to exist in. In stark contrast, the gravitational field, as described by Einstein and created by the mere existence of matter, is more than just a region of influence within space and time. It is space-time. Einstein went to great lengths in Appendix 5 of his booklet to clarify his thinking on this. In a new preface to the 1954 edition, he says, "Space-time is not necessarily something to which one can ascribe a separate existence, independently of the actual objects of physical reality. Physical objects are not in space, but these objects are spatially extended. In this way, the concept of empty space loses its meaning." Then, in Appendix 5, he clarifies this further. "If we imagine the gravitational field to be removed, there does not remain a space of the type 1, in other words, flat space-time, but absolutely nothing. Flat space-time, judged from the standpoint of the general theory of relativity, is not a space without field, but a special case, which in itself has no objective significance. There is no such thing as empty space, in other words, a space without field." He concludes, "Space-time does not claim existence on its own, but only as a structural quality of the field." Building on the ideas of Aristotle and Descartes, Einstein generalized the notion that there is no space without material bodies, and showed that there is no space-time without a gravitational field. Just like our magnetic field, the gravitational field is a real physical thing. It can bend, stretch, and undulate. But it is more fundamental than the electromagnetic field. The electromagnetic field needs the gravitational field to exist, since without a gravitational field, there is no space-time. Expansion of space. There is one final point I wish to make before I move on. A common confusion many have with the idea of space-time curvature becomes apparent when physicists describe the expansion of the universe. If space-time is one big static four-dimensional block, what does it mean when physicists talk about it expanding? How can something that includes time embedded within it expand? After all, the word expand suggests something changing with time. But that something contains time. The answer is that the expansion of space that we observe through our telescopes does not involve any stretching of the time coordinate too. It isn't space-time that is stretching, but rather only the three dimensions of space expanding as time moves forward. Although space-time is in some sense democratic, with time as just one of the four dimensions, we can algebraically manipulate the equations of general relativity, by which I mean recast them in a slightly different form, so that all distances will now be multiplied by a scale factor that increases as time moves forward and only space expands. Remember also that this expansion only happens in the vast expanses in between the galaxies, because within the galaxies themselves, the gravitational field that holds them together is strong enough to withstand the overall cosmic expansion. Galaxies are like the raisins embedded within a loaf of rising bread in the oven. The loaf expands, but the raisins themselves remain the same size. They just become more separated from each other. In terms of the block universe, imagine that our local space-time sits within a bread universe, in which successive slices of the loaf, as we move along the time axis from past to future, get bigger. Floating outside of space-time, you just see the static loaf with its increasing slice sizes. But from our vantage point trapped within the loaf, or within a figurative raisin within the loaf, all we can experience is successively larger slices. And so we see a point, a distant galaxy, say, moving further away from us as we move through the slices. Despite all these deeply profound concepts, everything about space-time that I have described in this chapter comes from just one of the three pillars of modern physics, But space, according to relativity theory, is smooth and continuous. If we zoom in smaller and smaller, we will ultimately reach the domain of the second pillar of modern physics, quantum mechanics, where everything is fuzzy and subject to chance and uncertainty. What then happens to space and time at these tiniest of length scales and shortest of intervals? Will space-time itself become grainy, like the pixels of an image magnified beyond its resolution? Maybe. We will come to that soon. The block universe in relativity also says that we can think of time as static and unchanging, with past, present and future coexisting as part of our four-dimensional space-time. But the third pillar of physics, thermodynamics, tells us that the idea of time as just another dimension is inadequate. Thermodynamics describes the way systems change with time. More than that, it gives a directionality to time that is missing from the three dimensions in space. Independently of our own perception of time flowing in one direction only, born from the fact that we remember the past, live in the present, and anticipate the future, there exists an arrow of time that points from the past to the future, ruining the neat symmetry of the block universe. But we're not yet ready to explore these next two pillars of physics. First, we must fill our space-time with stuff, matter and energy. The lesson from Einstein is that matter, energy, space and time are all intimate companions. We will explore what this means in the next chapter.